So we like totally screwed up the scheduling this week. We like lost our guest. We started 30 minutes late. We had no agenda. It's literally a miracle that there is a podcast this week. So in honor of that, I thought what I'd do is, instead of playing our normal intro music, I thought I'd treat you to one of the alternative tracks that Mark mixed when we were trying to decide what we'd have as our intro music. So here goes.
You're listening to In Tech We Trust, because if you can't trust technology, what else can you?
Episode 49 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. Welcome, one and all, wherever you are. We're pretty determined to make this the best show ever. So we haven't got an agenda. There's like 2.5 of us on the show. I'm the half, and we haven't got a clue what we're going to talk about, but I think it's going to be a blast. So, Mark, Rick, welcome to the show, gentlemen.
We're going to nail it.
Yeah.
We're going to nail it, did you say?
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, we're starting late. Not that anybody who's listening to this on a recording knows anything about that. But we're going to have to make it a bit of an express show because, Rick, you need to nick off in probably about 30 minutes, something like that.
Yeah. But unfortunately, listeners might wonder, where does Rickatron go? Towards the end of the podcast, I do have to relieve the childcare here at 7 p.m. local time. So that's what's up.
Yeah, you do tend to like just trail off and then not be there anymore at the end, I guess. Yeah. Anyway, let's jump into what news we've got this week. I'll run through it all dead quick, and then we'll just start picking things apart. So Seagate are buying Dot Hill, the OEM vendor of the MSA that HP sell, rebrand OEM, looking to buy them anyway. Seagate looking to buy Dot Hill for about $650 million. We've got a bit more information on 3D cross-point memory. Mark is going to have a bit of a chinwag about that. Paul Moritz is stepping down as CEO of Pivotal. And I know we talked about this a little bit last week, the Gartner Magic Quadrant for hyperconverged, or whatever they decided to call it. I can't even remember now. Integrated systems, I think. Rick, you're going to want to talk about that as well. But you know what? Why don't we start the ball rolling with the Seagate to buy Dot Hill story? $650 million. I suppose, first up, is that a lot, or is that like is that a steal?
To me, it seems like a lot. And I'm not sure what that number is exactly, Nigel. I just told you that, but that's in the ballpark.
Okay, fair play.
And, you know, Dot Hill is a company that is, not a household name, right? People don't necessarily know who they are. They've got some OEM business. The thing that was interesting to me in reading the announcement about it, and I can't remember which news service I saw it on, but it was explained that it was like a cloud thing,
oh,
right? Yes, it was totally cloud washed. You know, that somehow Seagate buying Dot Hill was going to enable Seagate to sell to cloud service providers. And
I'd say, Mark, right, in my opinion, that they would be almost, not the antithesis, but like pretty much as non-cloud as you can get, right? So my idea of Dot Hill is those kind of, I'd tag it with legacy almost, like little mini storage arrays that HP and maybe even when it was Compaq used to resell, but pretty much have been squeezed out of the HP portfolio with the mini little 3PARs these days. So it's almost non-cloud as you can get. I mean, these things have been around since like the dawn of storage almost, and it feels to me like they don't even seem to have moved on, certainly not cloud.
Well, there's a market for that. Low end, you know, the only real feature is RAID and a basic snapshot. There's a market for that today in storage.
Totally, but it's not cloud, right?
I get you. Couple of points of note right there. They had 104% year-over-year growth for 2014, but you got to remember, they also lost that OEM with HP. So
wait a minute, just to get these facts kind of semi-right. So they lost the OEM with HP, and they still made 104% year-on-year growth.
Well, this is before that took effect.
Oh.
So fourth quarter, let me give a better number. Fourth quarter, 2014, non-GAAP vertical market revenue grew 104% year-over-year. That is a very qualified number because it was good. Now, Here's the number that I think, you know, gives you a sense of where Dot Hill is. And then if you think about that purchase price, right? So for the year ending 2014, the way they report, I'm looking at their press release, net revenue was $217 million. Yeah, $217 million of revenue compared to $206 million for 2013. That's not incredible growth in the bottom line, and that's honestly not a lot.
It's just a really small number anyway. That's practically what my consulting company did. Well, it's not really. But it's such a low number, right? I mean, that's...
Well,
but your educational projects are going to do much better than that.
Just wait till the Pluralsight invoice goes in.
Yeah, that's true.
But no, the thing is, though, think of that year revenue. It's roughly a multiplier of 3 to get that buy price. So I don't think it's too far off market. But just to give everyone a sense of, you know, how big is this deal? That's how big
it is. But what's the future for them as well, right? If they've lost that HP OEM deal, what's their main routes to market? Because let's be fair, right? This is a crowded market space. And even in that kind of low-end market that you talked about earlier, Rick, that's, you know, basically just discs and RAID and a few cables and what have you, nothing necessarily snazzy, you've got to say that things like it, and maybe, Mark, you might have an opinion on this, but even some of like the smaller Pure and Tegile and boxes like that, they would sell at those kind of capacity points, I bet, but much more modern architectures with, you know, a lot more features and a lot more cloud ready, if I can say that.
Well, I kind of think of, you know, the cloud storage is, for the most part, being disk drives inside server systems, not external systems. So I don't get it. I mean, how many cloud service providers are buying, you know, mini RAID or JBOD or that kind of thing, right? They're just buying disk drives and shoving them in servers.
Yeah.
Yep. There's, and even outside of cloud, there's that renaissance revival of local storage, right? Capacity's good. RAID controllers are good enough. And this, the features of things like hypervisors really seal the deal. And then the advent of solid state storage. I think, honestly, not local storage isn't a bad choice on the small side either for where this traditional kind of base feature storage. It's curious to see where Seagate's going to go with it. Maybe it is cloud. Maybe, you know, Seagate might come out with some nice unified storage, you know, that, you know, does good things, right? We'll see where it goes. But this is Seagate's. It's a big step for them to get into the market of an entire storage system rather than just a drive.
Although they already bought Ingenio. Right, Ingenio, you know, the maker, the contract manufacturer of storage systems for other companies. So I don't get it. I mean, they've already got, you know, a subsystem manufacturing capability. Do they need another one?
Yeah, I mean, what are they doing here? They're picking up the dregs that, you know, so Ingenio used to be OEM'd by IBM. They closed that down, I think. Now HP closed down the OEM deal with Dot Hill, and what, they're going to go and scrape that up. I mean, you know, talking about hypervisors and things, right? So when I used to be a customer, quite often out in branch offices and things, are local storage solutions for small branch offices quite often were an MSA 2000 or something. But to be honest, we really started, and this is like, this is a year, 18 months, 24 months ago now, we were starting to phase those out with just putting in, you know, 3 ESX servers with, like you say there, Rick, local storage, and just running with that instead. That way the storage team was never involved. It was always just the virtualization team or the Windows team or whatever. I see this as a, I don't know, it's a technology from like at least 10 years ago, and I don't think it's moved with the times.
Well, it's probably the best thing that could have happened for Dot Hill.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Oh, are you kidding? This is a gift to Dot Hill. I mean, is somebody, you know, like from Dot Hill, like on the board of HP? I mean, you kind of wonder, what the hell is this deal? I just, whatever. Let's move on. I think we skewered this one pretty well.
Okay, so speaking of something that is then a lot more modern, not necessarily cloud, but could potentially underpin the cloud in the future, 3D cross-point memory. What do we think about that?
Yes, now called Optane, right? Intel and Micron continue to lift the curtain on this a little bit, right? So they've got a brand name for this new memory, Optane.
So, sorry, Mark, is that OCTane or OPTane?
OPTane.
Right, okay, Optane, yeah.
Yeah, one of those words, you know, who knows how they made it up, but they did, and there you have it. And there was some speculation at the Flash Memory Summit last week, which I know that on the previous show we had just derided this thing, like, you know, shows at the Santa Clara Convention Center is actually pretty well attended. I was surprised, very surprised. Saw a lot of interesting people there. And the session that was done, now Micron and Intel didn't show up for this session. There was a lot of speculation about it. And guys were, you know, guys that thought they were the smartest guys in the room. Some of them I think actually knew. They knew a lot more about memory than I did. This was packed, and they had to open up extra side rooms to get everybody in to hear about it. So there's a lot of interest in this stuff, right? And a guy said, and the guy presenting, Dave Eggleston, and I can't remember Dave's name, he said it's a kind of phase change memory, PCM. But that's not the case. It looks like it's coming out this week that it's something else. It's some kind of phase change plus something else. I had people telling me it was actually resistive memory. But it does look like it's coming. And the thing that's interesting now is that Intel is talking about having this stuff be available next year in 2016 as an SSD.
Oh, okay.
So what looks like it's going to be, you know, server memory that will fit on the system bus close to CPUs. Their first instantiation of it is going to be as SSDs. And then sometime in the future, 1 or 2 years later, supposedly, they'll do the system bus memory modules.
Okay. And do you know, Mark, from a characteristics perspective, so things like the way that it performs for reads versus writes and wear leveling and stuff like that, does it have characteristics that are similar to NAND flash that we have today? So what I'm thinking is, you know, if you're an array vendor or if you're a server vendor or whatever, and you've built firmware and all kinds of frilly stuff around the way that NAND flash memory works, is this like a drop-in replacement for that that's faster, potentially a better price point in the future, but lasts for longer? Or are we going to have to like rewrite all of our controller software and things for it? Do we have a grasp for that?
I think the idea of the SSDs is that it will be plug and play, swap like, just faster,
mm-hmm.
lower latencies. Because, you know, the numbers that Intel and Micron give for it are outrageous. You know, 1,000 times faster, 1,000 times more reliable than NAND, right? So it won't be as fast as DRAM, but it'll be in the, microsecond range, not millisecond range, but it'll be very fast and supposedly more reliable. The interesting thing is, you know, if you use it as an SSD, you don't have to worry about the timing quite as much. It's just going to be faster than, you know, your old SSDs. But if you put it on the system bus, it's a different problem. It's not deterministic memory like DRAM. You know, DRAM where you've got specific timing cycles that you have to meet. This stuff's not going to work that way. It's going to have variable timings, and so that's probably why they're going to come out a few years later with the memory that fits on the memory bus, because they're going to have to write controllers for it, and the timeout, you know, the timings are going to be different than for DRAM.
So a bit of an out there question about this then. Ultimately, and I can't put a date on this, but I'm thinking in that 2, maybe 3 year time period, do we think that the SSD or disk drive form factor will still be dominant then? Or do you think we'll get to the point where, you know, sticking them in as a disk drive will very much be looked as shoehorning it in, and we'll be looking at things that are directly on the system bus in the future?
Well, I think the idea of them doing it as an SSD first allows them to ramp up manufacturing and shake out the technology, right? Where they really want to go is connected to the system bus, and I think what you're going to see in, you know, in a 3 to 4 year time frame is Intel trying to recreate the mainframe with in-memory database technology that'll be quite large and quite fast.
That'll be interesting.
I think you're going to see this Gen 1 approach that fits with what we've got, kind of like what Mark explained, and it's kind of like what we've seen with SSDs. You could replace, you know, regular rotational drives and get an immediate but not necessarily fully optimized benefit. So it's going to take some time, get the market, give people a taste that's affordable, and then, you know, come in with something better, some innovation. Backstream systems are going to change, but, you know, hard drives are not going anywhere, tape's not going anywhere, cloud's not going anywhere. There's more stuff, there's room for everything.
Yeah, I think the impact on the market, this stuff will be quite a bit more expensive probably when it first comes out, right? So it's going to have to complete with NAND flash, and it's going to be a lot more expensive. Who's going to buy it? So Intel and Micron will have to be creative about, you know, how they package it and sell it. But, you know, they'll need to get the speed up. But I think the effect is that it's going to continue downward price pressure on NAND flash. And that just means that NAND flash is going to get cheaper and cheaper so it'll be easier for people to buy, you know, high density, high speed, you know, high density, high speed NAND arrays and, you know, SSDs.
Well, one of the things that's typically helped to drive down the cost of products like this has been them finding a place in the consumer market. So let's say Apple or somebody picks up on it and puts in a big old order for the next generation of iPhone or something like that. Does this have use cases in the consumer space that might see production have to ramp massively and therefore drive down cost?
Yeah, I don't know why they wouldn't. I mean, and Apple hasn't said anything. You know, Apple's the most secretive company on the planet. You know, Intel is close to it, but Intel's trying to start getting the word out on this. You know, if you wanted to have a like a motion picture studio and a phone or something, you need really high density memory. I mean, who knows what Apple will come up with? But this might, you know, let's just, you know, go wild, just all wild now, and hypothesize that maybe Apple would put this in phones and allow you to do that much more, you know, with high speed, high density memory.
Also, watch the gaming industry, consoles, game consoles. Agreed. They might latch onto this too.
Agreed.
Sweet. Okay. Well, before you sleek off the podcast, Rick, you wanted to say something about Gartner's recent Magic Quadrant about integrated systems or converged systems. We did talk about it on the show last week, but you weren't on. What do you want to say about that?
Well, first of all, you know, I do think no matter what anyone's thinking about this type of platform, you know, it's a good read. There's a lot of good talk, a lot of good reads out there. But one thing I wanted to identify is, since then, I guess it was just today or yesterday, a good friend at the Register, Mr. Meller, his topic was yellow and blue circles, red arrows added to the quadrant. So in there, he showed movement or projected movement, which is, I'll be honest with you, you're not allowed to do that to an MQ. So the listeners might want to check that out or follow the drama that comes with that. But basically, there's some, you know, projected movements there. So you might want to see that based on – I don't know exactly where this is coming from, partly from possibly last year's. There's new players, more players now, that's clear. But, you know, to kind of qualify the movement, that's an interesting – there's some really good up, some really good down. But you're not supposed to do that, but it's been done. Might want to check that out.
I don't know that you would call that good down, right?
Good moves, some substantive moves.
Big move, right? And the two big losers there are IBM and Lenovo. Huge direction going the wrong way. Yep. Down and to the left.
Yep. Yeah, it's just an interesting look at the market, you know. Because honestly, it's confusing to me. Because there's too many players, honestly. We've complained about other quadrants not having enough, so I might as well complain about this one having too many.
It was pretty crowded, actually, wasn't it? Somebody mentioned Lenovo as well, though. There are rumors. I don't think at this point anything is certain at the moment, but there are rumors, aren't there, that Lenovo are striking up some kind of deal with Simplivity. Does anybody know anything about that?
Oh, where's Gabe when you need him?
I know, absolutely, yeah.
Chapman, come on, Gabriel.
We don't need Gabriel this week because you've got the background noise this week, Mark, so we're good, right?
I've got the noise down, yeah, I've got it.
Okay, switching gears very slightly then, Paul Moritz is stepping down as CEO of Pivotal. Obviously, long-time legend in the industry, a long time at Microsoft, had good time at VMware, Pivotal. I don't know. Has he done a good job at Pivotal, or is Pivotal in that's maybe a bit unfair. Is Pivotal in a good place? Have they achieved what we maybe thought they might achieve when they were first formed?
Well, what a great question. I mean, a few months ago, my answer would have been yes, I think so, but I'm not sure. I really don't know. I'm not close enough to where their business is to see how it's going.
Well, he held the position for 3 years, which tells you, you know, these are groups that have high expectations, right? That's something that is, it's a pretty good amount of time, but maybe some longer term expectations weren't being met or such. I'm not sure. It's hard to read. He's proven, right? There's no question there. You know, I struggle with Pivotal and, you know, what they try to do and you know, I should probably go ask Eddie Sipek. He probably worked there at some point, but that's a joke. But, you know, it's like it's kind of a big deal, I think, because they need to have that top leadership with that experience. And I'm trying to figure it out myself. Like you, Nigel, I don't run into it much, but it's an interesting move, and I doubt it's for good reasons, you know, and there's no sight of, okay, for personal reasons or health or, you know, want to be with family. None of that stuff was ever noted. So without a reason is natural draw to suspicion, in my opinion.
No, I totally agree with that. And I think the only one link that I've seen on it so far was a Fortune link, and it was a dead short article as well. And I think it was all speculation. I don't even know. I mean, I could be wrong about this, right? But I don't even know that anything official has been said yet. I just think that, you know, when it was originally spun off like 2-3 years ago or whatever it was now, there was, at least I remember, that there seemed to be a bunch of fanfare around it, and then a kind of lull, kind of like trying to almost work out what they were going to do, and felt to me like they struggled to find their feet a little bit and have never actually really taken the world by storm yet. Maybe I'm being harsh on them there. Maybe I set the expectations too high based on the fact that, you know, it's effectively an EMC and a VMware company, and those guys do tend to do stellar things. So I don't know. The jury is out on them as a company and whether or not they're a success for me. But you know what? They're like 2-3 years old, yeah?
Yeah, so I mean, when that first spun out, I was working at Microsoft, so I had a bias, you know, against them, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, you know, it's just a place where they're collecting cast-offs from both VMware and EMC, right? They had Greenplum and, you know, a bunch of other stuff, and some of those things have, you know, look like they've continued to make it, and some haven't. I think, you know, I think that Paul was left a bunch of assets that he had to try to figure out how to make a business out of. And it's not clear that there's a big business there. It's not clear that the assets that he had would have worked out anyway. I don't know. It's interesting. And maybe it's going great guns. It seems strange though. If the company had been doing really well, I don't think that Paul would be leaving. I just don't believe that, but what do I know?
Well, I struggle trying to put it in a tweet or a sentence what they do, but I'll tell you this, that I got one stat from earlier this year, from January. Pivotal Cloud Foundry has booked $40 million in software sales. So I got one number. You know, that's not huge. VMware, EMC, those type of big expectations.
Oh, yeah. No doubt, yeah. I think as well, I seem to remember a little while ago, they seem to have like a really confusing story on whether or not they were open sourcing a bunch of stuff and what the reasoning behind some of that was and whether they were kind of really open sourcing it or not. I don't know. I've just always had mixed messages, and yeah, I would kind of struggle to say I know exactly what Pivotal do as a company. But let's not haul them over the coals, because it sounds like none of us would consider ourselves experts on it. We're running a bit short on time, actually. This is an IntequiTrust Express show. So there was one more thing in the news which you brought to our attention, Mark. I think you're a longtime customer of Ashley Madison. Is that right?
No, and if I was, you'd be able to look me up on their data.
So just tell us real quick. Ashley Madison is a website for cheating adults. Is that right?
Well, cheating is a pejorative term, but it's a place where adults get together to find each other, apparently.
Oh,
and
okay.
People can subscribe to the service and pay for something or other on there because there's credit card information. And then, so what happened is hackers got into the site and are now exposing the members of Ashley Madison.
They're exposing them, are they? Oh, right.
They are exposing them, apparently, from what I've been reading, along with credit card information, phone numbers, all of this stuff, so that if, you know, suspicious, what are they calling it, family lawyers can go in there and fish for cases, apparently. And
wow. That's a wreck. Oh.
Yeah, that's a wreck. And, you know, it's really interesting. You know, you look at hacking and all number of things, and, you know, people lose financial information and all of that kind of thing. Here's a case where hackers are going after cheaters, and it will probably result in the disintegration of families.
Which is never a great thing, is it? You know,
I don't think that's a great thing. I don't think, you know, for me on this thing, I just like, really, hackers, this is what you want to do? Is it your place? Is it your morality to go after and do this? I mean, where do you get off on this, hackers? What is that about? You really,
black
you
on really black on black.
You really think you've accomplished? Yes, thanks, Rick. That said it.
Well, you're not going to find my address and name, credit card, or any associated alias there. But yeah, it's just—I mean, that's just fully, properly distasteful, coupled with fully, properly distasteful. And then when those that lawyer Fisher type.
Honestly, we're talking like ambulance chasing type stuff there. Yeah,
that space. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that's going to work, but there have been, you know, snidely comments on Twitter about that. So, you know, I'm probably heaping coals onto the fire, but yeah, I can see where that would happen.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting here comfortably because whenever I sign up to a service like that, I use the pseudonym Mark Farley. So I'm all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at least somebody else has stolen credit card numbers. Yeah. So we can both, you know, claim, you know.
To be honest, though, you know, if I was on a site like that, oh, gosh, dear me. You know, I've got three kids and a wife, of course. And if I was facing, you know, my credit card details being exposed or the fact that I was, you know, doing naughty things, shall we say, on a site like that, I think I'd quite happily have my credit card details exposed and keep the other part of it secret. You know, not just, I'm not talking about protecting me here. I'm thinking like, you know, the feelings of my kids and my family and that kind of stuff. That's just, oh, dear. I mean, that's like life-changing stuff. I'm not talking and saying that losing your credit card details and stuff isn't bad, but you know, you've got insurance and stuff like that. I don't think, I mean, you guys have got insurance for everything in the States, right? We're always 10 years behind you guys, but I'm pretty sure you can't insure yourself against having an affair and your wife, I don't know, taking you to the cleaners, can you? Or can you? I don't know.
I don't know, but
I don't think there's insurance for that, Nigel. I don't think there's any insurance for being caught in any way. But it's a funny thing, right? You know, the internet, the thing that allows all things, then allows, you know, there's always a boomerang effect somewhere. And why do you store anything on the internet anymore, right? If whether it's at a bank, you know, a government institution, an adult dating site, you know, it all just gets out there and everybody can find out about it. It's you know, brings up the whole security problem in a very seedy way.
Yeah, it does. But those same security issues would apply to whether you're running your business on Microsoft Azure or Amazon Web Services or something like that. You know, any time you put your business, you put your financial data, you put your credit card, anything important out there, you are, I mean, it's just the way of the world these days, isn't it, right? You can't run your business now without being on the internet, having a major internet presence and stuff. But man, this really highlights that there are bad people out there. And you know what? I suppose it's the cyber equivalent, isn't it? If somebody, you know, hacking, right, is the cyber equivalent of somebody driving a truck, backing it up into your office and nicking off with all of your wares and what have you. Except if you do that, then the police seem to have a way to kind of track you down and, you know, you can call the police and take action. Whereas anything that's done on the internet, you know, it's bounced through China and North Korea and all kinds of stuff. And who then goes and hunts these people down for you and gets justice? Nobody does it, do they?
No. And to me, the thing that I find particularly annoying about this is the holier-than-thou attitude of the hackers. Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Screw you.
Draw the line somewhere, right? There's hacking, right? And then there's just dirty hacking like this that's below the belt.
There you go. That
in more ways than one, below the belt.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
Black on black and below the belt. Something like that.